The following is a selection from the book The Lake Regions of Central Africa by Richard Burton, presented by ListenToGenius.com, narrated by Simon Vance. Lake Tanganyika. The route before us lay through a howling wilderness, once populous and fertile, but now laid waste by the fierce Watuta. Sneh bin Amir had warned me that it would be our greatest trial of patience. The march began badly. Mpete, the district on the right bank of the Malagarazi River, is highly malarious, and the mosquitoes feasted right royally upon our life, even during the daytime. We bivouacked under a shady tree within sight of the ferry, not knowing that upon the woody eminences above the valley there are usually fine kraals of dry grass and of umkora, or mnyombo bark. During the rainy monsoon the best encampments in these regions are made of tree sheets. Two parallel rings are cut in the bowl at a distance of 6 to 7 feet. A perpendicular slit then connects them, the bark is easily stripped off, and the trunk, after having been left for a time to season, is filled for use. On the 5th of February we set out betimes across a route traversing for a short distance swampy ground along the riverside. It then stretched over jungly and wooded hill spires with steep, rough ascents and descents, divided from neighbouring elevations by slippery mire runs. Exposed to the full break of the rainy monsoon and the frequent outbursts of fiery sun, I could not but admire the marvellous fertility of the soil. An impervious luxuriance of vegetation veils the lowlands, clothes the hillsides, and caps their rounded summits. After marching 5 hours and 20 minutes, we found a large kraal in the district of Kinawani. The encamping ground, partially cleared of the thick, fetid and putrescent vegetation around, hugs the right bank of the Malagarazi and faces the village of Sultan Mzogera on the southern or opposite side. A small store of provisions, grain and sweet potatoes, was purchased from the villagers of Kinawani, who flocked across the stream to trade. They were, however, fanciful in their requirements. Beads, especially the coral porcelain, iron wire, salt, and meat. The heaviness of this march caused two of the hamels engaged at Usagozi to levant, and the remaining four to strike work. It was therefore again necessary to mount ass, 10 days after an attack of paraplegia. We left Kinawani on the next morning, and striking away from the river we crossed rugged and rolling ground divided by deep swamps of mire and grass. To the southward ran the stream, rushing violently down a rocky bed, with tall trees lining its banks. Sailing before the morning east wind, a huge mass of nimbus occupied the sky, and presently discharged itself in an unusually heavy downfall. During the afternoon the breeze veered as usual to the west, and the hot sunshine was for once enjoyable. After a weary trudge of 5 hours and 20 minutes, we entered a large and comfortable kraal, situated near a reach where the swift and turbid river foamed over a discontinuous ledge of rock between avenues of dense and tangled jungle. No provisions were procurable at this place. Man appeared to have become extinct. The 7th of February led us over broken ground, encumbered by forest and cut by swamps, with higher levels on the right hand, till we again fell into the marshes and fields of the river valley. The district on the other side of the river, called Jambeho, is one of the most flourishing in Uvinza. Its villages of small bird-nest huts and its carefully hoed fields of grain and sweet potato affected the eye after the dreary monotony of a jungle march, like the glimmer of a light at the end of a night march, or the discovery of land at the conclusion of a long sea voyage. The village ferry was instantly put into requisition, and the chief Ruwere, after receiving as his dash 8 cloths, allowed us to purchase provisions. At that season, however, the harvest of grain and sweet potatoes had not been got in, and for their single old hen the people demanded an exorbitant price. We hastened, despite all difficulties, to escape from this place of pestilence, which clouds of mosquitoes rendered as uncomfortable as it was dangerous. The next day ushered in our departure with drizzling rain, which drenched the slippery paths of red clay. The asses, wild with wind and weather, exposed us to accidents in a country of deep ravines and rugged boulders. Presently diverging from the Malagarazi, we passed over the brow of a low tree-clad hill above the junction of the Rusugi River, and followed the left bank of this tributary as far as its nearer ford. The Rusugi, which drains the northern highlands into the Malagarazzi, was then about 100 yards in width. The bottom is a red, ochreish soil, the strong stream divided in the centre by a long, low strip of sand and gravel, flowed at that time breast deep, and its banks, as usual with rivers in these lands, deeply cut by narrow water courses, rendered travelling unusually toilsome. At the Rusugi ford, the road separates into a northern and a southern branch, a hill spur forming the line of demarcation. The northern strikes off to the district of Paruguerero on the left bank, where a shallower ford is found. The place in question is a settlement of Wavinza, containing from 40 to 50 beehive huts tenanted by salt diggers. The principal pan is sunk in the vicinity of the river. The saline produce, after being boiled down in the huts, is piled up and hand-made into little cones. The pan affords tripartite revenue to 3 sultans, and it constitutes the principal wealth of the Wavinza. The salt here sold for 1 shuka per masula, or half load, and far superior to the bitter nitrous produce of Ugogo, finds its way throughout the heart of Africa, supplying the lands adjoining both the Tanganyika and the Nyanza lakes. We followed the southern line, which crosses the Rusugi River at the branch islet. Fords are always picturesque. The men seemed to enjoy the washing. Their numbers protected them from the crocodiles, which fled from their shouting and splashing, and they even ventured into deep water where swimming was necessary. We crossed, as usual, on a unicorn of porters, the upper part of the body supported by 2 men and the feet resting upon the shoulders of a third, a posture somewhat similar to that affected by gentlemen who find themselves unable to pull off their own boots. Then, remounting, we ascended the grassy rise on the right of the stream, struggled, slipped, and slided over a muddy swamp, climbed up a rocky and bushy ridge, and found ourselves ensconced in a ragged and comfortless kraal upon the western slopes, within sight of some deserted salt pans below. As evening drew in, it became apparent that the Goanese Gaetano, the 5 Wakhutu porters, and Sarmala, a donkey-driving son of Ramji, had remained behind, in company with several loads, the tent, 2 bags of cloths, my companion's elephant gun, my bedding, and that of my servant. It was certain that with this provision in the vicinity of Paruguerero they would not starve, and the porters positively refused to halt an hour more than necessary. I found it therefore compulsory to advance. On the 11th of February, 3 children of Said bin Salim consented, as usual for a consideration, to return and to bring up the laggers, and about a week afterward they entered Ujiji without accident. The 5 Wakhutu porters, probably from the persuasions of Muinye Wazira, had, although sworn to fidelity with the strongest oaths, carried into execution a long-organized plan of desertion. Gaetano refused to march on the day of our separation because he was feverish, and he expected a riding ass to be sent back for him. He brought up our goods safely, but blankets, towels, and many articles of clothing belonging to his companion had disappeared. This difficulty was, of course, attributed to the Wakhutu porters. Probably the missing things had been sold for food by the Goanese and the son of Ramji. I could not, therefore, complain of the excuse. From the Umswahili Fondi, Fatore, Manciple, or Steward, of a small caravan belonging to an Arab merchant, Hamid bin Suleyam, I purchased for 35 cloths, about thrice its value, a little single-fold tent of thin American domestics, through which sun and rain penetrated with equal facility. Like the cloth houses of the Arab travellers generally, it was gable-shaped, 6 or 7 feet high, about 8 feet long by 4 broad, and so light that, with its bamboo poles and its pegs, it scarcely formed a load for a man. On the 9th of February we descended from the ridge upon which the kraal was placed, and traversed a deep swamp of black mud, dotted in the more elevated parts with old salt pans and pits, where broken pottery and blackened lumps of clay still showed traces of human handiwork. Beyond this lowland, the track, striking off from the river valley and turning to the right, entered toilsome ground. We crossed deep and rocky ravines, with luxuriant vegetation above and with rivulets at the bottom trickling toward the Malagarazzi, by scrambling down and swarming up the roughest steps of rock, boulder, and knotted tree root. Beyond these difficulties lay woody and stony hills, whose steep and slippery inclines were divided by half a dozen waters, all more or less troublesome to cross. The porters, who were in a place of famine, insisted upon pushing on to the utmost of their strength. After 6 hours' march, I persuaded them to halt in the bush upon a rocky hill, where the neighbouring descent supplied water. The Fondi visited the valley of the Rusugi River, and finding a herd of the Mbogo, or boss kaffir, brought home a welcome addition to our well-nigh exhausted rations. The 10th of February saw us crossing the normal sequence of jungly and stony neat's tongues, divided by deep and grassy swamps which, stagnant in the dry weather, drain after rains the northern country to the Malagarazi River. We passed over by a felled tree trunk an unfordable rivulet, hemmed in by a dense and fetid thicket, and the asses, summarily pitched down the muddy bank into the water, swam across and wriggled up the slimy offside like cats. Thence a foul swamp of black mire led to the Ruguvu or Luguvu River, the western boundary of Uvinza and the eastern frontier of Ukaranga. This stream, which can be forded during the dry season, had spread out after the rains over its borders of grassy plain. We were delayed till the next morning in a miserable camping ground, a mud bank thinly veiled with vegetation in order to bridge it with branching trees. An unusual downfall during the night might have caused serious consequences. Provisions had now disappeared. Moreover, the porters considered the place dangerous. The 10th of February began with the passage of the Ruguvu River, where again our goods and chattels were fated to be thoroughly sopped. I obtained a few corn cobs from a passing caravan of Wanyamwezi and charged them with meat and messages for the party left behind. A desert march, similar to the stage last travelled, led us to the Ungwe or Uvungwe River, a shallow, muddy stream girt in, as usual, by dense vegetation, and we found a fine large kraal on its left bank. After a cold and rainy night, we resumed our march by fording the Ungungwe. Then came the weary toil of fighting through tiger and spear grass, with reeds, rushes, a variety of ferns before unseen, and other lush and lusty growths, clothing a succession of rolling hills, monotonous swellings where the descent was ever a reflection of the ascent. The paths were broken, slippery, and pitted with deep holes. Along their sides, where the ground lay exposed to view, a conglomerate of ferruginous red clay, suggesting a resemblance to the superficies of Londa, as described by Dr. Livingstone, took the place of the granites and sandstones of the eastern countries, and the sinking of the land toward the lake became palpable. In the jungle were extensive clumps of bamboo and rattan, the former small, the latter of poor quality. The bauhinia, or blackwood, and the salsaparilla vine abounded. Wild grapes of diminutive size and of the austerest flavour appeared for the first time upon the sunny hillsides which Bacchus ever loves, and in the lower swamps plantains grew almost wild. In parts, the surface was broken into small, deep hollows from which sprang pyramidal masses of the hugest trees. Though no sign of man here met the eye, scattered fields and plantations showed that villages must be somewhere near. Sweet water was found in narrow courses of black mud, which sorely tried the sinews of laden man and beast. Long afternoon we saw the caravan halted by fatigue upon a slope beyond a weary swamp. A violent storm was brewing, and while half the sky was purple-black with nimbus, the sun shone stingingly through the clear portion of the empyrean. But these small troubles were lightly borne. Already in the far distance appeared walls of sky-blue cliff with gilded summits, which were as a beacon to the distressed mariner. On the 13th of February we resumed our travel through screens of lofty grass which thinned out into a straggling forest. After about an hour's march, as we entered a small savannah, I saw the Fondi before alluded to running forward and changing the direction of the caravan. Without supposing that he had taken upon himself this responsibility, I followed him. Presently he breasted a steep and stony hill, sparsely clad with thorny trees. It was the death of my companion's riding ass. Arrived with toil, for our fagged beasts now refused to proceed, we halted for a few minutes upon the summit. "What is that streak of light which lies below?" I inquired of Sidi Bombay. "I am of opinion," quoth Bombay, "that that is THE water." I gazed in dismay. The remains of my blindness, the veil of trees, and a broad ray of sunshine illuminating but one reach of the lake had shrunk its fair proportions. Somewhat prematurely I began to lament my folly in having risked life and lost health for so poor a prize, to curse Arab exaggeration, and to propose an immediate return with a view of exploring the Nyanza or Northern Lake. Advancing, however, a few yards, the whole scene suddenly burst upon my view, filling me with admiration, wonder, and delight. Nothing, in sooth, could be more picturesque than this first view of the Tanganyika Lake, as it lay in the lap of the mountains, basking in the gorgeous tropical sunshine. Below and beyond a short foreground of rugged and precipitous hillfold, down which the footpath zigzags painfully, a narrow strip of emerald green, never sere and marvellously fertile, shelves toward a ribbon of glistening yellow sand, here bordered by sedgy rushes, there cleanly and clearly cut by the breaking wavelets. Farther in front stretch the waters, an expanse of the lightest and softest blue, in breadth varying from 30 to 35 miles, and sprinkled by the crisp east wind with tiny crescents of snowy foam. The background in front is a high and broken wall of steel-coloured mountain, here flecked and capped with pearly mist, there standing sharply pencilled against the azure air. Its yawning chasms, marked by a deeper plum colour, fall toward dwarf hills of mound-like proportions, which apparently dip their feet in the wave. To the south and opposite the long low point behind which the Malagarazi River discharges the red loam suspended in its violent stream lie the bluff headlands and capes of Oguha, and as the eye dilates it falls upon a cluster of outlying islets speckling a sea horizon. Villages, cultivated lands, the frequent canoes of the fishermen on the waters, and on a nearer approach the murmurs of the waves breaking upon the shore, give a something of variety, of movement, of life to the landscape, which, like all the fairest prospects in these regions, wants but a little of the neatness and finish of art, mosques and kiosks, palaces and villas, gardens and orchards, contrasting with the profuse lavishness and magnificence of nature and diversifying the unbroken coup d'oeil of excessive vegetation to rival, if not to excel, the most admired scenery of the classic regions. The riant shores of this vast crevasse appeared doubly beautiful to me after the silent and spectral mangrove creeks of the East African seaboard, and the melancholy, monotonous experience of desert and jungle scenery, tawny rock and sun-parched plain, or rank herbage and flats of black mire. Truly, it was a revel for soul and sight. This is Simon Vance for ListenToGenius.com. Thank you for listening. This audio program is copyrighted by Redwood Audiobooks. Permission is granted to download for personal use only, not for distribution or commercial use.